Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the third of this year's Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures, which, of course, are being given by Professor Richard Layard. Richard's subject is a very important one of happiness, and those of you who have been here for the first two lectures will know Richard has set out a fascinating set of propositions which integrate analysis from genetics, from economics, from neuroscience, philosophy, and psychology. Propositions which, if they are correct, if we are convinced by Richard, significantly change our beliefs about some of the objectives of economic policy. The story so far roughly goes that in lecture one, Richard has argued that happiness is a specific measurable phenomenon, but a phenomenon sadly no longer increasing as the world of the mature economies gets more prosperous. In the second lecture, Richard explored in more detail the complex relationship between income and happiness and explained how processes of habituation and rivalry explained the paradox that richer people in any one country at any one time are happier than the poorer, but that as the whole of society gets richer, people don't overall get happier. And he gave us some early hints yesterday of policy implications that follow, including the proposition that tax is positively good for you because it makes you work less, a proposition which he has already explained to American libertarians, though apparently without immediate success in convincing them that they are totally wrong. But they will be convinced, I'm sure, after Lecture 3. They haven't heard Lecture 3 yet. And tonight, Richard's going to turn to the full range of policy prescriptions which might follow from his analysis. Richard.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to begin with a true story about a civil servant friend of mine who went to a primary school with the Bishop of Lincoln. And they went into a classroom and the children were sitting on their little chairs, and there were two little chairs in front where my friend and the Bishop sat. The Bishop, for some reason or other, was in his mitre and chasuble. But he then said to the children, boys and girls, who can tell me what is grey and furry and lives in trees? So the children looked at each other. They thought this was a very strange question. And then one little boy put up his hand and he said, please, sir, I know the answer's meant to be Jesus, but isn't it a squirrel? The moral that I draw is that you have to ask the right question. And recently, the Treasury held a seminar which asked what I thought was exactly the right question, which is, what difference would it make if we really tried to make people as happy as possible? Well, that's a question which I want to talk about today. And in particular, as you might guess, I want to focus on where the answers differ from those that are often given by standard economists, employed, dare I say it, by the OECD. I'll choose a suitable distance. My main message will be that happiness depends on a lot more than your purchasing power, and in particular, it depends on your tastes, which you acquire through your experience, and on the whole social context in which you live. So when we evaluate policies which increase purchasing power, we also must take into account all the other channels through which those policies have their effect. So that's, roughly speaking, the first half of my talk. And then I want to come back to the question of our objectives, and I want to say why I think Bentham was right, and the greatest happiness should be the common goal of our society. Okay, let me start with some evidence on what makes people happy. Of course, the evidence we have at the moment is still extremely partial, but there have been very big strides by psychologists, and by some economists like Andrew Oswald, who started his work here and has continued it at Warwick to excellent effect. And most of the research points to seven main factors. which I've listed in no particular order. They are income, work, private life. SO, I recently discovered, means significant other. Community, health, freedom, and your philosophy of life. Yesterday, we discussed the significant but limited impact of income, so today I want to talk about the other factors, and I want to compare the magnitude of their effect with the effect of income. Now, here's a table which is based partly on Oswald's work on the Eurobarometer data, but mainly on a paper by John Halliwell, which uses the World Value Surveys, very interesting surveys, done three times now in 81, 91, and 96 in analyzable form. They cover 90,000 people in 46 countries. And where these world surveys overlap with the Eurobarometer ones, you actually get very similar findings. So this is not just chance results of one particular survey. And the idea of this table is quite simple. First, we measure a person's happiness, and then we try to explain it by a whole battery of facts about their situation. In each row of the table, we're measuring how each factor affects happiness, holding all the other factors in the other rows of the table constant. And later on, I'll show you the second half of the table. Now, to think about the size of the effects of each of these things, for example, being unemployed, I'm going to compare the size of that effect with the effect of income. So I'm choosing the units of happiness so that when family income falls by a third relative to average income, happiness falls by one unit. That's just the normalization to enable you to compare the importance of the other things. Well, you can see straight away that the effect on the individual of being unemployed is very great. And this is the effect after you've taken into account the effect of being unemployed on the person's income. So it's the purely psychic effect of rejection. Going on quickly, I'm going to go through these quickly and then reflect on them. Going on, we can look at people who are in work and see how they're affected by whether they feel their job is insecure rather than secure. And again, you're seeing a very big effect on their happiness when compared with, for example, quite a substantial drop in relative income. You're also seeing a big effect of family variables. I want to admit immediately that these family variables are not very perfect. They're a poor proxy for people's troubled or untroubled private lives, and there's surely some reverse causality going on with unhappy people being more likely, for example, to have a broken marriage. But even so, these are huge figures on the right-hand side relative to the effect of income. They confirm how important family life is compared with income. And so at the bottom is health. And I see that I've missed out these other two variables here, which are the general climate within which you're living rather than your personal situation. This is the effect of simply a movement in the unemployment rate on you, whatever your particular situation is, quite considerable and interestingly bigger than the effect of inflation. Some of you may remember the Economist Misery Index, which treated them as equally important. This says unemployment is more important. Well, one final comment on the table. The thing which we are comparing all this with is the effect of a fall in your income relative to the average. And as we saw yesterday, if society as a whole had decreased its income by a third, the effect on happiness would have been less than the effect of a fall in one person's relative income with other people not falling beside them. So you can see that we are sort of exaggerating the effect of a general increase or fall in national income as a standard with which we're comparing these other things. Well, I think this is a really informative table, and I hope you'll be interested in the other half of it when we get there. This is, nearly all these numbers are confirmed, as I said, by looking at other studies such as the Eurobarometer studies. And I want to point out the methodology here because I think it's an important part of the way forward. None of these findings could have been obtained by the standard method of economics, which is to infer valuation from behavior via so-called revealed preference, nor could they have been obtained by the normal method which psychologists use to ask hypothetical questions about how people would value changes. Instead, they reflect the most obvious and the most direct way of finding out what causes X, to measure X, and then see how all the different possible factors are affecting it. Just go for the jugular. That's what this table is doing. Now, I think that these findings are fairly devastating in their policy implications. And let me start with policy towards work. This kind of analysis can be done, of course, in country by country. And whatever country you study, unemployment emerges as, for most people, a major disaster. And this comes not only from comparing people who are currently employed and unemployed, as in this particular table that I showed, but also from taking the same person through the years and looking at their happiness as they move from employment to unemployment and back again. You actually get very similar estimates either way. So unemployment is a disaster. I think it's rather similar in a sense to marriage breakup. The fundamental change is that you cease to be needed. And this psychic effect is in marked contrast to the assumptions of many, perhaps most economists. When they think about unemployment, the first thing they think about is that there's a loss of output and income to the unemployed person and some others. And then they think maybe they should adjust that downward because after all the unemployed person's got more leisure. Our analysis shows completely the opposite, the huge psychic impact of unemployment on the unemployed person on top of whatever income the unemployed person has lost. And that's why low unemployment should be such a central goal for any government. It also means, which one finds it difficult to say in some company, that almost any job is better than no job. You certainly can't say that in France or Germany yet, but the evidence supports it, and that's why I believe in welfare to work. Now, if unemployment is such a disaster, it's not surprising that even when people are in work, they are much happier if they feel their job is secure, as we saw. Yet, there are powerful voices arguing that we can't afford to offer the job security which we once thought reasonable. At the OECD, which I mentioned before, flexibility is the best thing you can say about anything. So how could we not afford to make people as secure now that we're richer, when we could afford it when we were poorer? What do people in the OECD say about this? Well, there are two arguments which you'll hear. One is that employment protection was always a bad idea. That, in terms of the research done by the majority of labour economists, cannot be supported. You can't establish that employment protection had a strong effect one way or another on the level of unemployment. But a second answer, which of course we hear now, is globalisation. Globalisation is on the increase, and this has reduced the potential for stable employment. But as a matter of fact, in the British workforce as a whole, job tenures are as high as they ever were. And as a matter of principle, a country can always accept lower real wages if that's the price of the security that people would prefer. So that's a choice which is open to a society, but it's not generally open to the individual, because if an individual goes to an employer and says, I'd like more job security in return for a lower wage, the employer will wonder quite what he's up to. So that is the case for collective action. including legislation, to provide reasonable job security. And I think it's an important element of a civilized society. But most Americans consider that European labor relations are far too gentlemanly. And so I think it's not surprising that Europeans want to keep their own way of doing these things, especially when north of the Mediterranean they've achieved US hourly productivity without US levels of insecurity. Let me mention the pace of work. In order to improve performance, workers are under increasing pressure to achieve targets, and this is leading to increased stress. For example, in 1996, this Eurobarometer survey I mentioned asked employed people in every country whether in the last 5 years there had been a, quote, significant increase in the stress involved in your job. Nearly 50% of the respondents said yes, increased stress. Under 10% said less. And Britain was similar to the European average. Now, again, there are people who would argue that this is the pace of work that people have signed up to. They've chosen it. But the fact is that not all options or combinations are available. I want to give you an example of a very interesting study of US lawyers. They, of course, now work, they probably work harder than anybody in the world, I don't know, perhaps some people in the city. They work harder than they used to, anyway. And a survey was done of associates in US law firms, which showed that they would much prefer to work shorter hours for less pay. But that's not something that they can bring about, because again, there's a problem of the lemon. If the person goes along and proposes to work less for less pay, this reflects on their commitment. And what's happening is that the partners in the firm are using the work hours as a test of other qualities which they can't observe. This is the macho phenomenon going on in so much of the financial and legal sector. So in the face of these kind of imperfections, we obviously need a new approach to the work-life balance. I discussed a part of the strategy yesterday, as Adair mentioned, it's simply to tax people. If they work more, tax them more. And that will tend to discourage some of that excessive self-defeating work. But I think that we also need a change in cultural priorities in which we get performance, meaning, of course, the GDP, that's what performance is, into its proper place. So how, for example, should we regard the standard OECD view that we need more entrepreneurship and risk-taking? You hear this almost every day. What's interesting there is that this is, of course, a statement in flagrant contradiction of any received economic theory, which says that no one set of tastes is better than any other. And what is clear is that for most people, the desire for security is a central part of their nature. And that's why we set up the welfare state, why we've introduced stabilization policy in every advanced country. And of course there have been mistakes, terrible mistakes, in the design of welfare states. In many countries, income is guaranteed to people even if they ignore the work that's available. But it does seem to me that as we become richer, it must be mad if at the same time we become less secure and more stressed. It seems to me obvious that security and a quiet mind are what economists call normal goods, which should be increased and not decreased as people become richer. Yet we have this extraordinary situation where the elite in America and Britain glorify novelty. Let me pick on civil servants. They gaily reorganize public services, oblivious of how each reorganization destroys a major channel of personal security and of trust. I'll refer to trust later, but I believe that we actually have a lot to learn from old Europe, as we now call it, where the value of stability is better understood than in Britain and America. Let me turn to a different area, security in the family and the community. I'm not no expert on this, and I just want to discuss one relevant factor, which is geographical mobility. And I want to do this in order to illustrate the problem which arises when policies are advocated because they would increase GDP, although they may have other effects on happiness which are negative. So economists generally favour geographical mobility. Why? Because it moves people from a less productive to a more productive place, and therefore increases the GDP. But it's equally obvious that geographical mobility is not good for crime and not good for family stability. Families will tend to be more stable if people are living close to their parents and old friends with a network of social support. Similarly, if people are highly mobile, they feel less bonded to the people among whom they live, and crime is higher. And I want to give you some evidence on this. Crime is found to be, I'll do it the other way around, crime is lower when people trust each other. That's one study, or a number of studies show that. The number shows the next bit, that people trust each other more if fewer people are moving house and the community is more homogeneous. I think these are really important findings that we have to take seriously. Because if we look at the negative, the bad side of modern societies, I think the growth of crime is the most obvious failure of our society. And in some countries, the growth of crime is clearly linked to a decline in trust that I'll be coming back to. Similarly, you're more likely to be mentally ill if you live in an area where your group is in the minority, as compared with if you live in a group, live in an area where your group is in the majority. So there are really important costs to mobility which must be taken into account before we are all urged to match US levels of geographical mobility. And I think that these facts that I've mentioned are very relevant both to the question of internal mobility and to the question of international mobility and immigration. Let me come now to a more individual condition, health. Self-reported health, as you might have seen, is strongly related to happiness, but there's an obvious reporting problem that can arise here, and objective measures of health are actually much less closely correlated with happiness than most people think, except for cases of multiple and severe chronic pain. So the first conclusion I would draw about ordinary health services is that the social arrangements for healthcare are extremely important because they bear directly on the subjective experience, and they should be taken very seriously relative to the targets for objective health, which are now absolutely up at the front line. But of course, for subjective health, by far the most important is mental health, and that is the dimension of health which is much the most closely related to happiness. In fact, one might say that most of the worst unhappiness in our society is caused by mental disorder, especially depression and schizophrenia. I think it's a real scandal that we spend so little on mental health. Let me give you some WHO figures. Mental illness causes one half of all the measured disability in our society. And if you add in, as the other medical problem we have, premature death, it's still the case that mental illness accounts for a quarter of the total suffering and loss of life caused by disease. Yet what fraction of the NHS budget goes on mental health? 12%. What fraction of the Medical Research Council budget? 5%. Looking at it from the point of view of people, roughly a quarter of all people experience serious mental illness sometime in their life, and about 15% experience a major clinical depression. In the post-war period, we've discovered how to treat depression, and most depressives can be greatly helped by a combination of drugs and cognitive therapy. Yet what percentage of people now suffering from depression in this country are being treated? You may like to guess, but I'll tell you the answer: 25%. And what treatment are they getting? What fraction of those who are being treated are seeing a psychiatrist or have seen a psychiatrist? 10%. So 25% are being treated, and they're being treated by non-specialist GPs. This can't be a sensible or serious way of addressing one of our main sources of unhappiness in our country. And I think if we were serious about attacking unhappiness, we would totally change this, and we would make psychiatry a central and high prestige part of the NHS rather than the Cinderella. In fact, if you actually think about post-war history, perhaps the single most striking improvement in human happiness has been among people who suffer from schizophrenia and depression, who were untreatable before the war and can now be helped. With that behind us, it's tempting to speculate about where we might be going. Even today, after only 50 years of research on these kind of questions, many people are being helped on a permanent basis by drugs to feel themselves rather than feel some substandard person that they only half recognize. And I think as drug research advances, it would be very surprising if more and more people couldn't be helped to be what they feel is the real them. Let me move to another level of my big seven, the bigger community, the system of government and laws. From the comparison of countries, which I did on Monday, you can see that people hated communism to a quite extraordinary degree, even ignoring its effects on income. And in the analysis which I showed you earlier, done by John Halliwell, he brings in these other factors which help to explain the happiness of the 90,000 people that he's studying. So here again we have the same normalization. I'm doing it in terms of increases rather than decreases. So we're calling the change in happiness from a rise of 50% in relative income unity, and we're now comparing that with an improvement in the quality of your government. Now, the index of political standards here involves six different dimensions, and the result shows a huge difference in happiness associated with, for example, a government like that of Hungary in 1995 rather than Belarus. If you didn't know, Belarus is still communist. And there are at least three dimensions in here. There's your ability to exert political influence on the government, your personal freedom, like free speech, and your economic freedom to do business. And all three are at work in these inter-country results, and you can see how important they are to people holding income constant. As regards political democracy, there's been a remarkable study by Bruno Frey in his home country of Switzerland, because you know they have referenda there. And he's compared those Swiss cantons with the most frequent referenda with those Swiss cantons with the least frequent referenda, and looked at the happiness in each of them, other things equal. And the resulting difference in happiness, according to this increase in referenda, is roughly equal to the effect of doubling income. Now, I mean, this is a one-off study, but I think it's very provocative, and we should have many more such studies to try and find out actually what political institutions do to the happiness of the population. So, I'm just getting to the end of my first half. I just want to summarize the main policy points I've made today and yesterday. First, self-defeating work should be discouraged by suitable taxation. Second, producers matter as much as consumers and should be incentivized by professional norms and not ever more financial incentives. Third, we should not promote the search for status, and we should limit dysfunctional advertising. Four, income should be redistributed towards where it makes most difference. Five, secure work should be promoted by welfare to work and reasonable employment protection. Six, security at home and in the community will be lower. There's too much geographical mobility. Seven, mental health should receive higher priority. And eight, we should have genuine democracy. But I want to draw one more general conclusion at this point about the limited power of economics to resolve policy issues on its own. And that's the point I made at the beginning, that almost any policy that affects income also affects happiness through non-income channels, which have to be taken into account for a full analysis. For example, in this diagram here, I'm looking at a few factors bearing on happiness, and I'm looking in particular at income as one, family security as another one, and as I argued before, mobility may raise income, reduce family security, and we need to look at the balance of those. And to really know how to think about this, we need a whole massive program of quantitative research on what is the scale and manner of the non-income influences affecting human happiness. And I do suggest that this ought actually to become, for a time, the top priority for the funding by the ESRC. And then the second point that I want to make about economic thinking is that it needs to take into account not only the multiple channels, but what it itself is doing to people. Because economic theory, of course, assumes that people are normally selfish. And as I shall show in a while, teaching people that can actually make them more selfish. And if they're more selfish, that has an influence on the happiness of society. So that's the other dotted channel that I'm saying we have to think about. So I'm now moving on to the question of values and the philosophy of life. Okay, well, I think there are two aspects to a philosophy of life. There's how you interact with yourself and how you interact with other people. Obviously, people are happier if they're able to appreciate what they have, whatever it is, if they don't always compare themselves with other people, and if they can school their own moods. I think Daniel Goleman, who wrote the book about emotional intelligence, was quite right. It exists, and it can be taught by parents and by teachers. I love the poem by Sir Henry Wotton on the happy man, which ends, "That man is freed from servile bands of hope to rise or fear to fall, lord of himself, though not of lands, that having nothing yet hath all." And I think the clearest statement that I've come across is by Viktor Frankl in his book on man's search for meaning, where he wrote about his experiences in Auschwitz, and he concluded that, quotes, "Everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." And people obviously have many different ways of disciplining their minds and their moods, from cognitive therapy to Buddhist mindfulness, to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. But what all of these are doing is helping people to find comfort from within in all sorts of ways. And these generally include some system of relying for help on the deep positive part of yourself rather than on the more scheming part of yourself. And some people, if you can go back to the table, would call this force God. The table reports, this is one of the most robust findings of happiness research, which is why I put it up here, that people who believe in God are happier. Unfortunately, there's the same problem of causality. No one's sorted out whether it's belief that's causing happiness or happiness that's encouraging belief. And of course, I'm not encouraging anybody to believe against their reason that I report the fact. So happiness depends on how you interact with yourself, but also, of course, it depends on how you interact with others and on how you perceive them. And that's what I'm going to talk on for the rest of today. People are much happier, as you can see here, if they feel they live in a friendly and harmonious world. In surveys, people are regularly asked, would you say that most people can be trusted? Or would you say that you can't be too careful in dealing with people? As the table shows, those who say that people can be trusted are happier. That's if they say it themselves. That's his first... Here's my pointer. That's my first row here. If you're if you believe that people can be trusted, you're happier. But also, if you live in a society where other people think people can be trusted, you're happier. So it's the ambiance as well as your own feelings. But the depressing thing is that on these measures, trust has been declining sharply in both the US and Britain. And here are the figures for Britain and the US. Let's take Britain first. In the late 1950s, nearly 60% of people felt that most other people could be trusted. By the 1990s, it had fallen to around 30%. And here's a picture for the US, a similar sort of fall. Now, I was warned that I mustn't sound like an old fuddy-duddy. I certainly also don't want to be one. And I know that there have always been Cassandras who say things are going to pot. And that is why I think the following evidence is extremely interesting. In 1952, half of all Americans thought that people led as good lives, moral and honest, as they used to. So there was no majority of people then who thought the world was going to pot. So it's not true that people always think the world is going to pot, but they do now. Because now nearly three quarters of people think that people are less moral and honest than they used to be. I think this is quite a serious feature of our society, and if this weren't the case, it'd be quite difficult to explain why we haven't got happier as our lifestyle has improved so much. What has caused these changes is not really clear, and I don't want to claim anything on that. I think increased mobility, increased family breakup may have contributed to the decline in trust and maybe even in standards of interaction. But I think that there are important intellectual influences. That's why we have universities, after all. And they come mainly, of course, through the assumptions which people imbibe in their childhood. And in this context, it's interesting that the downward trend in trust in the US is not because individual people have become less trustful over their lifetime. It's that each generation starts off less trustful than the preceding generation. So this suggests that what happens to people's moral education in home and school is really important. And I want to end by discussing what kind of moral philosophy we should be espousing. Now, if we look at the last 100 years, the most obvious change in our ideas has been the decline in religious belief caused by the progress of Darwinian science. And that's removed the sanction of the afterlife. But I also think that for some time the effect of that change was masked, at least in this country, by the rise of socialism or quasi-socialism as a moral code involving mutual obligation. But now we've had the failure of socialism in action at a world level, and I do believe that has left something of a vacuum which has been filled by fairly untrammeled individualism. Robert Putnam has documented this, that individualism has become the dominating ideology in Western culture since the late 1970s. And of course, economists have their way of supporting the individualistic view that things will work out fine by the invisible hand, and that what we must do, and this is in the extreme case, is just to establish property rights and a legal framework, plus all the other problems I mentioned earlier on. But what I want to draw attention to now is that it's just not right that establishing property rights and a legal framework can do the job for you. You can't specify the contracts adequately, and the courts cannot operate efficiently enough to produce good outcomes unless most people have already got a taste for good behaviour. More important, the pursuit of individual self-interest is not a good formula for personal happiness. You'll be happier if you also obtain happiness from the good fortunes of others. And in fact, the doctrine that your main aim must be self-advancement, I think, is one of the major sources of anxiety in our society. So what about economics teaching and all this? As I said, we tell people they're selfish, and it's not surprising they become more so. Robert Frank has done a number of studies on this. He asked his students at Cornell whether they would report it if they were undercharged for something they bought, and also whether they would return a lost addressed envelope, which they found containing $100. And he asked them this in September when they came to Cornell, and again in December after their first term. The students who took introductory economics became less honest, whereas the astronomy students became more honest. And the difference was significant. Similarly, he got people playing the prisoner's dilemma game. Will they cooperate or will they cheat on each other? Economic students were less likely to cooperate than other students, and the gap between them and other students widened the longer they studied economics. So it's quite serious, isn't it, if economic thinking is seeping increasingly into our culture. It may be having many good results, I do believe it is, but also the bad one of justifying selfishness. So I think that we are in somewhat of a moral vacuum today, where there's no really agreed concepts of how unselfish a person should be, or of what would constitute a good society. And I want to suggest that the right concept is the old Enlightenment one of the pursuit by society of the greatest happiness of its members. The good society is the one where people are happiest, and the right action is the one which produces the greatest happiness. Now, actually, I've always believed this, but I've discovered it's very unfashionable these days. Very, very unfashionable among philosophers. But they don't offer any alternative comprehensive theory which would help us to resolve our moral dilemmas. Instead, they support various separate values: promise-keeping, kindness, truthfulness, fairness, and so on. But what are we meant to do when these separate values conflict? For example, what should I do if I promised to go to my daughter's play and my father is taken to hospital? Should I keep my promise or be kind to my father? I see no way in which conflicts like that between principles could be resolved without reference to some overarching principle. And that principle would surely focus on the feelings of the people affected. And the question in this case would be how strongly each of them would feel if I didn't turn up. So my picture of moral philosophy is not about a limited set of moral dilemmas, which is what you would often think it was about when you read the articles of philosophers. It's about the whole of life. Fundamentally, the main issue in life, of course, is how you spend your time and how society should allocate its resources. And I cannot see how these issues could be resolved without some overarching principle. Now, there's one principle which sometimes is advocated as if it did it, which is do as you would be done by. But I can't see how that provides guidance on, for example, how the state should treat anybody, be he a criminal, child, or taxpayer. And even in private morality, do as you would be done by seems to require actually an excessive disregard of the person whose happiness you know most about, which is yourself. So I do want to propose that we take very seriously the principle of the greatest happiness. And let me deal with some of the objections and then attempt to justify the principle. Okay, one objection is that the concept of happiness is itself too vague and too hedonistic. I hope I dealt with that on Monday. Another objection is that the fact, another objection is to the fact that actions are judged only by their consequences, as if that this meant that the nature of the action itself is immaterial. It's said to be ignoring means and focusing only on ends. This is, of course, completely absurd, because when you're considering what to do, the feelings that are produced at the same time as you conduct the action are a part of the consequences of the action. The consequences begin from the moment you do anything, and they include the means and the end. Other people argue that you can't become happy by trying, so it's inconsistent to consider happiness as the goal. I think that's a non sequitur, because we have all kinds of goals that can only be pursued indirectly, and in any case the postulate may not be quite right. And finally, there's the most serious argument, which is that the greatest happiness principle doesn't imply any basic rights. And I would deny that, because I believe people become so miserable without basic rights that what we call rule utilitarianism would say that you must have basic rights, because the gain to the rest of society from infringing them is less than the loss to the people whose rights are infringed. Now, if the critic offered a convincing alternative ideology for public and private morality, we could, as I said before, argue about which was better. But since none is offered, it seems to me we have a choice between a society with no comprehensive philosophy or one that embraces utilitarianism. But even so, why should one accept the utilitarian objective? And I would like to base it on five propositions which show, I hope, that it's a logical development from our basic nature. So let me state these five propositions and then try to justify them. One, it's in our nature to want to be happy. And on Monday I explained how this acts as a basic motivational mechanism which has led to our survival. Two, we also want our relatives to be happy, and a parent's love is the strongest example. Three, as regards relationships outside the family, humans are innately sociable and in varying degrees helpful to each other. We know that genes are involved in this because twin studies show that the trait of cooperativeness is partly heritable. And this trait provides, if you like, the emotional support for the development of a moral theory. So does the next trait, which is an inbuilt sense of fairness, extending at least to the equal treatment of equals. And fifth, and finally, to all these ingredients in our nature, we bring the power of reason, which I think reasons about moral issues in much the same way that it reasons about the working of the natural world. In both cases, it wants a unified theory. In natural science, this desire, this impulse, has paid off extremely handsomely and made us masters of the earth. In moral philosophy, unfortunately, there has been less progress. But if we persevere, we surely have a chance to better master ourselves. So let me go through quickly those steps. Humans naturally seek the good of more than themselves. At least they seek the good of their kin. But fruitful enterprises with non-relatives also require cooperation. Natural selection will punish those who cannot cooperate with others and who instead seek only their short-run gain. So natural selection will select people with a degree of cooperativeness and also select societies which make their people be cooperative. We can discuss this in the context of the prisoner's dilemma involving two people. If we both cooperate, we both do better than if we're both selfish. So how can I ensure that if I cooperate, you don't cheat? Axelrod did, as many of you know, a series of simulations which showed that if I had to deal with you a lot, whatever strategy you followed, I would on average do best to follow tit for tat, meaning that I'd start off cooperating, but if you acted selfishly, so would I until you started cooperating again, and then I'd again cooperate. So in the struggle of life, people would do best who were initially cooperative, but also ready to protect their back. And I think we are those kinds of people, we humans, and that could be because natural selection operated like Axelrod simulations. However, our instincts for interacting with each other have also been refined by upbringing and by the values that we've taught and learnt. So that the result of joint product of nature and nurture is that we cooperate to an important extent because it makes us feel better. And I want to give you some evidence from an experiment in which people's brains were monitored while they played the prisoner's dilemma game. When they made cooperative moves in the game, their brains showed the standard signs of pleasurable activity, and when they cheated, they didn't. And this these readings on the brain happened before people knew the outcome of the game and whether the other player had cooperated. So in some sense, virtue is its own reward. But notice that I'm not talking just about reciprocal altruism, giving favours in expectation of favours returned. I'm talking about something that goes beyond that and explains why we help many people we'll never meet again. We tip taxi drivers, we vote in elections, we even dive after drowning people that we don't know. And these are social feelings deep inside us. But they've survived the test of natural selection because people who are made like that are liked by other people and used for rewarding activities. And they're liked because they don't always calculate. That said, we do also, of course, watch our back. In repeated interactions with people, we withdraw cooperation, as I suggested, if they behave badly. And in one-off interactions, we take care to find out about the person's previous reputation. So people who behave badly do generally get punished, and good behavior is springing not just from natural sociability, but from the fear of being caught. We have to have both, since natural sociability is not universal. But it shouldn't be underestimated. And of course it can be encouraged by good moral education, provided there's a clear moral philosophy to be taught. It brings me back to the question of the conscious formulation of our moral philosophy. We seem to have an instinct for fairness. This has been shown by a host of psychological experiments and the existence of the concept in most human societies. So if we value our own happiness, it's only fair if we value equally the happiness of others. This is harder for some people to do than others. It's certainly easier the more naturally benevolent we are. But if we step outside ourselves, as we feel we ought to, it seems extremely natural to say that the best state for society is where people are happiest, each counting for one. And going on, right actions are those which promote that state of society. Now you could argue, again philosophers do, that rather than look for a clear philosophy, we should just stick with our various different moral intuitions. But I want to argue that that wasn't the way we progressed in our understanding and mastery of nature. We didn't stick to our partial intuitive concepts of causality. We sought desperately for a unified theory which could cover all kinds of different phenomena, the fall of the apple and the rotation of the moon. It's surely in our nature to make moral progress by the search for an overarching moral principle and by its widespread adoption. I do believe such progress is possible. In the West, we already have a society that is probably as happy as any there has ever been. I believe that strongly. But I also think there's a danger that individualism may pollute our way of life now that divine punishment no longer sanctions morality. And if it did, we should all be less happy. So we do need a clear philosophy, and the obvious aim, I'm arguing, is the pursuit of the greatest happiness of all, each person counting for one. If we all really pursued that, we should all be less selfish, and we should all be happier. So my conclusion is, bully for Bentham. Let me end with these words which he wrote shortly before he died to the daughter of a friend. It was a birthday letter, and he wrote, quote, "Create all the happiness you're able to create. Remove all the misery you're able to remove. Every day will allow you to add something to the pleasure of others or to diminish something of their pains. And for every grain of enjoyment you sow in the bosom of another, you shall find a harvest in your own bosom, while every sorrow which you pluck out from the thoughts and feelings of a fellow creature, shall be replaced by beautiful peace and joy in the sanctuary of yourself." Pretty good advice.
Richard, thank you very much for that remarkable third lecture in this series, an enormous amount for everybody to think about. We are now going to take questions, and I think there are microphones around somewhere, but I wonder whether you could first of all give the microphone to Mr. Richard Robbins in the middle row there, who would just like to start us off and make a comment.
Chairman, just the family would like to make a public statement. The family would like to make a public statement, not a critique of the splendid lectures. A huge amount could be said about those who made the appeal for the money that promotes these lectures, and those who were donors. I'm wondering, is this working?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
But today, we'd just like to, the family would like to say something about one person in particular. That person quoted at the beginning of the lectures a passage from my father's autobiography in which he was describing the collaboration of Klaus Moser and Richard Layard and on the Higher Education Report as one of the great pleasures of his life. Happinesses, even. I noticed that you failed to read the last bit of the sentence, which was perhaps even more flattering, the other not quite being flattering, but a shared pleasure. What it meant to him to be on that committee to help promote, to suggest the expansion of activity of why, how, and where we are in intellectual life amongst a greater number of people was huge. What would have surprised him absolutely would have been the scale of this lecture series, which has now covered 19 speakers, including yourself, Richard. And any of us who've been involved in academic life and in organization and have noticed our own failures will realize what a colossal job it has been to gather those people together and produce this series. International economists, all of them. And we just like to say, while you're trapped there, Richard, how terrific it has been for us, and I'm sure many others too.
Right. Well, now we need a bit more criticism. questions. Who would like to... Right, there's one person up at the back there we'll take first.
Freddy Peschel, Economic History Department. Professor Leia, you've argued that people work too much because they want to maximize their income rather than their happiness. And to correct this, we will need some kind of taxation, or as we have. And the underlying assumption, of course, is that people do, in fact, care about their happiness more about income than they do about their income. And I would challenge this point because I think, or I've got the impression that most people rather think what they work for is necessary. They fulfill a duty. They have responsibility for a business. They need to pay back their student loan. They need to feed a family, whatever. What they do is necessary. They work hard and long hours because it's necessary and not because they have chosen it. So there is no real choice between happiness or work or whatever. It's rather to fulfill a duty, and then taxing them, of course, makes them very unhappy because they have consciously given up leisure and now they don't even get a proper compensation.
No, that's not quite right. They do have a lot of choice, of course, of how to live. They're not compelled to live in any particular way. What I'm saying is that people often choose a standard of living which they then have to keep up in a way that they didn't foresee when they chose it. That's one distortion. The other is the effect it has on other people, that if I choose and practice a high standard of living, it makes you feel worse off. And that again is something which at the societal level is self-defeating. So I'm saying there are two self-defeating processes at work, and it would be better if people scale down their efforts relative to the no tax position. So I'm not saying that they should necessarily be taxed higher than they are now, but that these taxes are performing a really important and useful role in discouraging people from even further escalating their living standards.
Okay, just over here.
Richard, if you look at trends in the way that people use their leisure time, so I'm just talking about leisure time, not the balance between leisure and work, you see that in the rich countries, the two activities that have increased their share of the uses of leisure time most are shopping and watching television, neither of which are closely associated with happiness, whereas the activities which are closely associated with happiness, namely things to do with friends and family interactions, have fallen in terms of their share of leisure time. The question then is, what does this say about your underlying assumption that people have an inherent evaluative capacity to scrutinize activities in terms of happiness, and that they tend to be attracted towards the activities that will most increase their happiness? The two things tend not to go together.
Well, I think, I mean, I know that what you're reporting, because I put the figures up myself, obviously people enjoy some activities more than others. Of course, if they were behaving optimally, leaving aside the issues I just discussed, like you did, it would be at the margin that they would be liking all activities equally. And quite probably, people are not doing this in an optimal fashion. There's probably not too much that you can do about how people choose to spend their time. I mean, the people have got to make their own choices. I'm not quite sure what you're suggesting, that people oughtn't to watch so much television, they ought to spend more time with family and friends because that's rewarding. What are we to do about it? I don't quite know. Well, as I said at the beginning, I think it's a bit like health. We eat. We're basically motivated to eat because we would die if we didn't. But it doesn't mean to say that everything we eat is healthy. And it's a bit the same with the way we spend our time. We're motivated to do it in a direction which we think is going to provide enjoyment either in the shorter or longer term, but we get it wrong many times.
Right, back there, then I'm going up there, and then the two down here, but back there first.
I'd quite like to query the speaker who said that people wanted more income. I must say I've worked both as an economist, I met Richard about 30 years ago, you won't remember me, and as a cello teacher. One of these creates happiness, and the other doesn't much. And we ask what people will do with their time. One of the biggest things that has happened over the last 15 years is that education has been geared towards production, towards... When my daughter wasn't going to university, she's done it now, she got a letter saying that it would help to increase the productivity and competition of this country from Mr. Blunkett. And was she please going to do the education? The notion that boredom... And Rowan Williams wrote a very interesting piece about boredom about a year ago in one of the papers. Boredom is one of the major factors leading to unhappiness. It leads to crime, it leads to... A lot of people I know work because they can't think what else to do with their time. The people with whom I play string quartets spend a great deal of their time trying to find out how they can earn slightly less and work slightly less. And I suspect that there's in fact, I might write to you about it. There's a place for a large research project on boredom and its contribution to unhappiness, which I suspect is tied up with all the other variables with which you're associated. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Well, there was a wonderful book written by Stefan Linder called The Harried Leisure Society, something like that. What? Right. Well, I mean, his point was that the higher your real wage, the more short of time you would feel. I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. If you look across society, the people who feel they just haven't got enough time to do everything are, on the whole, the high earners, and the people the low earners are the people who are probably feeling time on their hands. But it may not be the case. There are also some low earners, like the minicab driver, who is working at a completely impossible amount of time. So I'm not sure that there are any very simple generalizations, but you're quite right that there are many dimensions to the problem.
Somebody up there?
Yep.
Mark McLean, LSC. To what extent does old age bring with it an inevitable march towards unhappiness? And can policy reverse this in any way?
Well, you'd be very glad to know that old people are as happy as younger people. Actually, if anything, there's a bit of a dip around about 40 when people feel under the most terrific pressure. Until you get into very old age, older people report themselves just as happy and they're doing fine.
Somebody down here?
Yep. My name's Stuart Jackson. I'm LSE alumnus and a former market researcher. My memory tells me there were very big changes around about 1965-1970 that led to other changes that couldn't be foreseen at the time. The wage structure of international companies that I knew a lot about at that time changed as a result of pressure from younger people, whereas previously the salary levels had gone up steadily and then plateaued later in life. the younger people force scientists, research and development people, senior managers, or people who would become senior managers, force the salaries up. They said, we need the money now. And the price of that was that some people were very discontented later because they thought it was going to go up and up and up. Of course, they were told, in fact, it would plateaued earlier. And it did lead to an explosion of early retirement, because whereas some people, many people were being kept in jobs where they were just coasting, these people, the wage bill simply wouldn't allow it, and they had to be retired early. So I remember those changes, and I saw the results that followed from them.
Well, I certainly think that and there's a big puzzle, obviously, of what is causing the age earnings profile. All kinds of theories have been produced to try and explain why, on the whole, earnings go on going up longer than a person's productivity goes on going up. And it's even by far the most plausible theory is that that's exactly what people would like, because people like to feel they're making some progress, and it's a big mistake to have a big jump, because then people understand to an extent that you've then got something to live up to, which may be a bit too challenging. So there's an element of wisdom in the outcome.
Good. Now there's lots and lots of hands up. Richard, would it be okay if we take sort of two at a time to, in order, there are two people up there, and we'll take them one after the other, just up over there.
Yes, I'm Richard Hornsby from the Mond Trust. I was very pleased to hear you make mention of the dark side of the moon, or the Cinderella of health, which is, of course, depression and mental health. Insofar as I think the estimates of the costs of mental health and human suffering in this country are approximately £4 billion per annum, indirect and indirect costs. And since it affects one in four people, and since it's the lowest in priority of the current government and previous government health policies, do you see there's any way that this, which is obviously fundamental to human happiness, employment and so on and so forth, can be actually changed in any way?
Okay, and the one next door before you reply, so we'll do two at once.
So I'm Stephen Kushak. I'm an MSc candidate in European political economy. Sir, your idea of less geographical mobility and keeping communities homogeneous would lead to a segregated and thus xenophobic world. I hope you will agree that this would not lead to a good end. Do you not think it wiser to promote understanding of different cultures through educational programs to instill a greater sense of trust in heterogeneous communities?
On the last question, of course you have to proceed on both fronts. Certainly it's very, very important, everything that you said at the end. But I think it is there is a genuine quantitative issue about how much mobility is good for a society, and it's not obvious to me, at least, that we should have more, which is what the normal recipe from any visiting American economist is. Now, on the other one, psychiatry, I think that there perhaps is a chance. There is more interest in, I think, what people feel these days, than simply in the GDP, and I certainly, the fact that we had a seminar in the Treasury which was entirely devoted to what would we do if we wanted to make people happier is a rather good sign. They are taking it quite seriously, the people right at the top of the Treasury on the civil service side, and I think that's a good way in.
Right, good. The lady down here.
Thank you, Dahlia Litchfield. First of all, I should say you've made at least one person very happy today.
Thank you.
Because of your unified theory making very good underpinning for work that we do in our field, which is town planning. And I wonder whether what you have been talking about is written up and whether where one could find a paper on that. Right. Good.
Well done.
The other thing is the questions that arose at first of why do people pursue what are apparently the routes to unhappiness. The thing is that we need to ask ourselves the why in a systematic way, and there are very clear reasons for it. As you said, security is a thing people pursue for, would want, or security would make people happy. In a society in which high income is a measure of your worth and value and safety in position, people pursue high income because that gives them a sense, false sense of security, but it does. Why do people become competitive? They become competitive in the workplace because government policies such as the ruthless performance standards and rationalization and reducing staff, etc., causes people to seek security by undermining other people, by keeping the information to themselves, by not sharing, by not cooperating. It's, again, perhaps a false way, but it's a reaction to circumstances that are imposed upon them. So there's an awful lot that can be done to change the cultural environment that forces people into what eventually makes them unhappy. And that then takes me to the last point. As I mentioned, the work that we do in our field in certain different ways reflects what you're talking about, in part. There are clearly people who are working a lot on this live-work balance issues. I'm sure that in each one of the specific fields that our society is based on or using, there are people who work on certain aspects that contribute to your total theory. Is there any way in which you could create, if you like, a society of people who think that way and can enrich and supplement each other's work so that it moves on from being a one person's important three lectures into more of a proper social force?
The Layard Foundation is going to have to be established.
No.
There's
a movement called Positive Psychology, which has had a British summit in Winchester last July, I think it was, and a world summit in Washington last October. And it includes many of the world's leading psychologists. And it is an attempt just to get away from the situation where psychology was only concerned with the abnormal at the bottom end, and to look at the full range, including the higher levels, and to look at the impact of all the kinds of things which you do, like town planning, which is incredibly important to how people feel about their lives. So it's going on.
Now, I think we've really only got time for about a few more questions. What I'm going to suggest is I'm going to take three of them all together and then let Richard make a response to those and a final comment. I'm going to take the one at the back up there. Yep, up there. And then there's two people at the back down here after that. There's a chap. Yeah, right at the back. Yeah, sorry, the person in front of him. Yeah.
Vincent Pringle, MSc.
And can you be brief in the question as far as possible? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in this paradox. You showed on Monday, sir, that the former communist countries belong to the group of the least happy countries. And there were these same countries pretending to pursue the most anti-individualistic and the most communitarian policies. How do you explain this paradox?
Okay, that's one. And then lady back there, yep.
Thank you, Professor. I think I have learned a lot from your speech about happiness. Here is a story from China. In ancient China, a king always felt unhappy because so he sent out a lot of people to find the happiest man in the world. And one day the many people went out and find until they met a beggar. They asked him, "Are you happy?" The beggar said, "Yes, I think I'm the happiest man in the world." And so they all the people returned to the king and told the king about the story that the beggar was the happiest man in the world. And I want your comment on the story.
Yeah. And the man behind. Yeah.
Thank you, Richard, for your lectures. They were very stimulating. I actually work in the further education sector, not the higher education sector, but we teach at the level of school and we teach professional qualifications and we teach higher education. Yet I don't think income is the problem. The problem is increasingly across the whole of the caring professions, the civil service, etc., is the increasing auditing of our work to the extent that we are spending more time filling in forms to satisfy the audit of our work and spending more of our leisure time actually preparing for the work we are supposed to be doing. And what we have is a growing phenomenal amount of stress that people are having to live with, and that is increasing misery across the what used to be called the vocational sectors.
Right. Well, the last point, of course, I agree with very much, that, and I mentioned in the lecture yesterday, that there's a real danger that if you try and introduce too many forms of external motivation, and especially untrusting external motivations that are almost in the form of negative threats rather than positive rewards, you can undermine the internal motivation, which ultimately has to be a very major part of any system which functioning properly. On the beggar, of course, there's a very long tradition of this. Tolstoy and others we could quote who believed in the happiness of the poor and so on. It's not borne out, of course, by most of the research. as far as communism is concerned, it may be communitarian somewhat, but obviously the lack of freedom, as we can see from the equations that I gave you, completely outweighs any gain in community.
Good. Well, I think we'll...
And I've got no parting word, but I was struck thinking further of what was said just here. If anybody is interested in pursuing these issues or somewhere or other, please email me. This'll do, won't it? I'll tell you, r.layard@lse.ac.uk. And thank you for listening.
Good. Well, my finishing task is very straightforward, which is to say a word of thanks to Richard for this real feast of intellectual insight and provocation. Three things have struck me about it as we went along. First, that like all great intellectual contributions, it has unsettled assumptions and conventional wisdoms. Economists spend their life believing that maximizing GDP is a good thing, and Richard has revealed that this is not necessarily true at all. I certainly get the impression that it has made Richard very happy to identify any conventional wisdom that he can lay his hands on and to sort of poke it in the eyes. Second, like great intellectual contributions, it has taken us back to the basics of the relevant discipline. In economics, we often lose sight of the implicit assumptions that we are making as we develop our theories, assumptions like the inherent selfishness of people or the nature of consumer sovereignty or revealed preference. And Richard has very definitely taken us back to the core of economics, which was with the Benthamites, and ask us questions about what it is all for, what are the objectives. Finally, however, I think interestingly, what Richard has done is to draw an extraordinary story from many different intellectual disciplines. The question that he actually asked overall was, happiness, has social science a clue? But that presupposes that there is something called social science in the singular, rather than a numerous set of separate social sciences
each progressing in their own individual silo and progressing indeed quite separately from the natural sciences. And I think that progression in silos has tended to be the nature of much academic activity, partly inherently, because until very recently, for instance, neuroscience really didn't have much to tell us which could talk to the concerns of economists about what preferences were. But we are now on the verge of an ability to look across those disciplines and draw conclusions from them. And what Richard has done to a remarkable extent is to draw from many different disciplines, natural science and social science, and to create something which you would not have come to, which you would not have achieved at, if you had stayed within the silo of one of those disciplines. He has, of course, revealed to us that gazing at the stars is far more likely to make you happy than being an economist. And, of course, that implies that the sooner that the LSE is renamed the London School of Economics and Astronomy, the better for the whole of society. The other consequence of the complex nature of this multidisciplinary approach, of course, is that it has been a very complicated argument to follow, and that's why we have already advertised the website where you can assiduously get hold of the lectures and look carefully through them and understand all the intricacies of the argument. But let me finally just end by saying, Richard, thank you very much. This has been a real feast of intellectual understanding, which we have all tremendously enjoyed. Thank you very much.